Greetings. Welcome to St. Dominic's Weekly. This is Father Michael. An exciting show for you today with Father Michael Phones, who I had the opportunity to interview when we were gathered together at the Dominican Assembly. This is one of a series of interviews that I was able to do, and it was a fascinating interview and discussion around his own vocation and about his life of ministry. Last week, I had interviewed Father Dominic David on the occasion of him preaching for Our Lady Lourdes Novena. And if you listen to that show, there was a little bit of a question about vocations to the Western Dominican province. I had thought and had the impression that most of those who join have liberal arts background, perhaps a Bachelor of Arts, and not necessarily a scientific background. And I was surprised to find out there was an impression that we had a large number of folks who were Dominicans who recently had a scientific background. So we had a little discussion on that. Well, if you listen to the podcast, you knew that I said, I'm going to run the numbers. So I actually did. I sat down and looked for the last 30 years, everyone who's come to the Dominican order. And I won't say Father Dominic David was wrong, but I will say that my instinct, my impression was right, that there's about a little over 50% of those who have entered and stayed, Dominicans, vocationally, have liberal arts BAs, kind of a literary background. And those who come to the order from scientific backgrounds comprise only about 30% roughly. And then there's kind of the other category as well, economics and things like that. But a further refinement of that, as we were discussing this as the brothers, was that those who enter from liberal arts and philosophy tend to do so from very Catholic institutions. That is, places that would be very friendly towards a natural exploration and discernment of religious life. So Catholic universities, CUA, Notre Dame, Thomas Aquinas College, a very strong Catholic places of higher institution, whereas folks who come from, say, secular institutions tend not to come from the arts. They tend to come from the sciences. So that was something I hadn't quite put together, but it made sense that in our secular society, the one place where any kind of quote-unquote objective truth still exists is not in the arts, but in the sciences. There's a kind of objectivity there. And so reading Thomas Aquinas, as Father Dominic David mentioned last week, is kind of appealing. That sense of theology as ciencia, as science, is appealing to the scientific mind. So just to give a kind of a full circle on that discussion, my instinct that there are more Dominicans, or at least the majority of Dominicans, do have a kind of background from philosophy and theology was correct. But a further refinement that those who come from non-Catholic institutions, or at least in terms of education, have gone to secular universities, tend to gravitate to religious life from scientific background. Now, today we have a wonderful example, as I sat down with Father Michael Phones, of someone who did come from a scientific background, from studying geology at Stanford. And so we have a wonderful, wide-ranging discussion on his vocation, a story that was new to him in his own vocational discernment. I hope you enjoy it. It was one of the first times he'd ever shared it. And then also about his ministry. One thing to note is at the time we sat down for this interview, Father Michael was the pastor at our parish in St. Dominic's in Eagle Rock. And since then, to his surprise, but to all of our delight, he was asked to be the socius of the prior provincial of our province. That is basically kind of the vice president, the second in charge. So he's gone on to more provincial sorts of things. I wish I had known that at the time, at least, or that was in the wind. I could have asked him about those challenges in that future. But I hope you enjoy our discussion, wide-ranging and delightful in every way. So whether you're on the go or taking it slow, many, many blessings as you enjoy today's show. Welcome to St. Dominic's Weekly. It's Father Michael Hurley, and I stress the Hurley because I'm joined by a very special guest, another Father Michael Phones. Welcome, Father Michael.
Thank you very much, Father Michael.
this is gonna be a Father Michael congratulatory session. I think we could have brought how many Father Michaels are there in the province? Have you ever?
I don't know, but there were seven at St. Dominic's.
St. Albert's
when I was when I was a novice.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. So I think at one point in terms of the assembly. And I think we talked about this one time. We hadn't actually done it, but to try to take a photo of all the Father Michaels in the province and just have it just something, you know, something pithy, like, you know, the Archangel rises or something, or something very dramatic. But I'm joined with Father Michael. Father Michael is, we're actually here because as Dominicans, we're gathering all of the different parishes, and Father Michael is the pastor at another St. Dominic's in Eagle Rock, which is in Southern California?
Right, Los Angeles.
Los Angeles area. Yeah. Approximate to Pasadena, is that right?
Yeah, we're right in between Glendale and Pasadena.
Okay, very good. So,
and it is confusing because on a regular basis, Father Michael Hurley receives my email because I'm pastor at St. Dominic's.
That's right.
St. Dominic's all spelled out, and you're pastor at St. Dominic's, St. Dominic's.
Exactly, so...
And it only goes one way. You get my email. I've never had your emails by mistake.
You know, and let me be honest, your emails aren't that interesting. No, I'm teasing. No, it's interesting. I'll get, in fact, the other day when it happened, I think just literally yesterday or the day before, I read through it and I was just like, did I miss a meeting? Or I'm trying to remember who this person is or what the situation is. And then I get to the bottom, I see the context, and I'm like, oh, this is Father Michael Eagle Rock. When I see the saint all spelled out,
right.
Should be the cue. So I don't know how many you get. Usually what I just do is hit forward and put FYI, and you know what's happened there. So we, you know, we're twins, spiritual twins, and email sharing in that email account. So it's great to have you join us, and maybe to folks, perhaps. I don't think you've never served at St. Dominic's, or have you?
I've not been assigned to St. Dominic's. I did give a St. Jude mission.
Oh, nice.
Nubina. I think it's when I was student master, so maybe about 6 or 7 years
ago.
7 years
ago. Okay. Otherwise, so just maybe just to start out with just a little bit about kind of where you're from, how you entered the order, just to kind of set the stage for us.
So I'm from the Midwest. I grew up in a small town in central Illinois and came out west for graduate school. Uh-huh. I was studying geophysics at Stanford. And how did I become a Dominican?
Yeah.
I tell people because the Franciscan vocation director suggested that I look at the Dominicans.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Otherwise,
a referral.
I never would have, you know, considered the Dominicans at all. And so it was, you know, convenient for me to come over from the East Bay, from the West Bay over to the East Bay to, no. Yeah, I would come over from the West Bay.
I'm not going to check your bays. We're going to go with it.
Well, I was in Stanford, and I came over to, you know, St. Dominic's.
Sure.
To St. Albert's to meet with the vocation director over here. And it was funny, just a few years ago, I met the Franciscan vocation director. I was giving a workshop in the Diocese of Phoenix, where he's working now. And we sat at the same table. I didn't recognize him, but he was wearing his habit. And so I asked him, oh, are you from the California province? He said, yes. Oh, do you know Father Michael Weldon? Oh, and he looked at me kind of quizzically, and he said, I'm Father Michael Weldon.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And so
he didn't recognize you either.
No, of course not.
Yeah, okay.
I told him a story. And again, he said something. You know, all these years, I would tell people, I really appreciate this vocation director from the Franciscans, because he was a vocation director. He wasn't a recruiter.
Yeah.
You know, he was really thinking about my best interests and where God was calling me.
Yeah.
And so when I told him, you know, that I'd entered the Dominicans and you know, how he had been a part of that, he looked at me and said, well, normally when I had guys look someplace else, it was because I didn't want them.
All these years, you had this beautiful notion that he had seen into your soul and saw the seeds of a preacher being born
and I just didn't know I was rejected.
You just didn't. We weren't going to measure up. Oh, that is hilarious. That was, and that was just a few years ago.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So, it's funny how God works.
Right. It's probably, you know, good that I didn't find out until recently.
Yeah.
So, Father Michael Weldon suggested that I take a look at the Dominicans, and really out of obedience, I went. And I remember Father Anthony, our novice master at St. Dominic's, at that time was vocation director.
Oh, really?
And I walked down Birch Court, and from a distance I could see this guy, and I thought, it's 10 o'clock and he's still in his bathrobe. And of course, it was his habit. I'd never seen a Dominican habit before.
Really? Okay. Yeah. You had seen Franciscan habits,
I'd seen Franciscans.
Okay, but not the white.
Yeah. And and so it was, a whole new world for me. And, so that's, and basically, I entered, Father Anthony several times during my formation would tell me, I can't believe you're still here.
Really?
I drove over with my application in hand the last time that they were looking at applications. I mean, they looked at my application that day and voted on me.
Oh, my goodness. Boy, that's like more like 12-16 style than than 2018 style.
And of course, I didn't realize that at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
I didn't realize that people didn't do that.
Yeah.
So, which is why he was saying, because it was kind of a whirlwind introduction to the Dominicans.
Yeah.
And in a way, maybe it was good because I didn't have really any expectations. I didn't, some of my classmates had, gone to Dominican parishes or had known Dominicans for years or had been discerning for years. And I was like, well, I know I need to be here because I can't discern from the outside. So
you need to jump into the deep end of the pool,
right,
so to speak.
Right.
And what was it, something about what you were, so you mentioned you were studying at Stanford, geophysics.
Geophysics.
Yeah. Was there something about the study or the...
Well, it was a combination of things. Yeah. When I was at Stanford, I grew up in the Midwest, small town. I'd never really seen poverty.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen homelessness. And, Palo Alto is, quite well-to-do and beautiful. And across the highway is East Palo Alto.
That's right.
And that juxtaposition was something that really got me thinking, how does this happen in what I thought of as, ostensibly a Christian nation?
Yeah.
And also I had roommates from Korea and Japan. And, being graduate students, we talked about all kinds of things, including faith.
Sure.
And one was agnostic and the other one was nominally Buddhist. Nice. And so,
And you were born and raised Catholic.
I was born and raised.
Just to clarify.
Born and raised Catholic. Yeah. My folks were, I would say very devout.
We
went to Mass, even on vacation. The first thing my dad would do, we always left on a Saturday early in the morning and we'd drive, all day long. And, I would, at the end of the day, I'd want to get to the hotel and go in the pool.
Yeah.
And he would say, well, let's see where, can we make the vigil Mass?
Nice. You can make Mass. Nice.
And it was, that was, certainly something that was very formative for me.
Nice.
To see my dad. And I knew my dad prayed. Only because I saw him praying, kneeling at the foot of his bed at night when I would get up to get a drink of water or go to the bathroom or something. I'd see through the open door. Yeah, so he didn't know I knew.
Okay, so it wasn't like he was, kind of articulated or just kind of making it, but he was just kind of in the silence of his room, just had that sense of prayer.
Yeah, so I knew he prayed. I knew he wasn't doing it for show. He wasn't doing it for my benefit.
Yeah.
And so that sense that, my dad, who I... believe could do anything.
Sure.
Needed God, needed to be in communication with God was really, really important, I think, for me.
Nice. So back with those roommates that you're kind of having discussions at Stanford, at a high level cardinal discussions.
Exactly. And part of it too is, the research program, the project I'd gotten involved in was something that some other graduate students had been working on. It was analyzing some data that a class had taken. They were learning how to use paleomagnetic equipment. My area was paleomagnetism, the study of the magnetic field of the ancient Earth. Hmm. And so they had collected data but hadn't quite analyzed it, or it wasn't really making sense. And so I think another graduate student had looked at it and had moved on. And so my director gave it to me to take a look at. And I'd been working on it for maybe a month, trying to make heads or tails of it. And I went and looked at the raw data, the data they collected out in the field before that had been entered into the...
And where are they collecting, like in the Midwest, like Utah?
No, they were collecting down by the San Luis Obispo area. They were deep sea sedimentary rocks, turbidites. They are formed in basically undersea landslides.
Oh.
And so this was a project to try to determine where they came from, what latitude were they formed. And another paleomagnetic study by some folks in the U.S. Geologic Survey, I believe, said they came from the equator. And geologists were looking at the rocks and at the fault movements and said, we can't see how they moved more than maybe 500 miles, from the south to north. And so this was supposed to help answer that question, where did they come from? And what I discovered was a field error had been made by every group except for one, which is why the data wasn't quite making sense. And unfortunately, they hadn't kept, back in the day, they used magnetic tapes, and no one could find the magnetic tape that had the raw data. So I had to enter it all by hand. And so, day after day, I'm entering, these
reams of numbers. Yeah.
Thinking, what am I doing? why am I doing this?
Yeah.
And, given what I'm seeing in the world around me now, sort of the economic disparity. And, I remember walking down a street in Palo Alto and I passed a woman who was, obviously very wealthy, and right as we passed, sitting on the curb where we passed, was a homeless guy taking a sponge bath, and none of us looked at
each other.
Mm. And I thought, there's something wrong here, and so all of what am I doing with my life, and what's meaningful, and is it meaningful to study the magnetic field of the ancient Earth when I'm 65? Do I want to look back and say that's what I did with my life?
Mm.
What about these other issues? What about people who don't believe? And so I was thinking, well, maybe I'll, take a leave of absence and join the Peace Corps, or maybe I should be a social worker, And I was riding my bike to the U.S. Geologic Survey for a meeting, and I happened to pass right across the street, St. Patrick's Seminary.
Oh, yeah,
and
right
there. Yeah, so this, this idea just kind of popped into my head. Well, maybe I should be a priest.
Hmm.
And I kind of shook my head, said that that's
nightmare.
Not my plan.
Yeah.
But it didn't go away. Mm. So people talk about, receiving a call.
Yeah.
I was given a question, a speculation.
Yeah.
I'd always been faithful. I'd always gone to Mass. Even in college, in my undergrad, I had some buddies that would kind of tease me and call me Father Mike because I went to Mass on Sunday.
On Sunday, okay, not just Christmas and Easter,
right?
Okay,
right.
Yeah.
But I had never, thought about being a priest, and until that moment, and I began. I tried to ignore it. I thought, this is crazy. How can I do this? But it just kept niggling at me. And, I found that I'd be, trying to study and this thought would come back, you should be a priest. What's that about? And so I started talking to a priest I knew at the church that I was, helping out with music at. And he taught Old Testament at St. Patrick's. And so one day I just kind of screwed up my courage and sat down and said, tell me about being a priest and how does that happen? And, and so we had some wonderful conversations, and I went to a come and see weekend at the seminary. And then, I remember thinking, I know what diocesan priesthood is like, and you're there by yourself. And I think I could do that. I'm an introvert. I'm comfortable in my own skin, but being part of a community that would, having to deal with people, that would be more of a challenge and probably better for making me holy.
Wow.
Yeah, of course it sounds great. It sounds great.
Good in theory.
In theory, yeah.
But no, because it's interesting, because most people come at community from a sense of, I need this support, I would really sense of loyalty, but you're saying it would be a challenge and that would be actually be good for me. So that's
right.
A different, that's an interesting perspective that I think most folks, when they talk about community, don't necessarily have that insight, or at least see that as an advantage, but an advantage that's going to draw themselves out rather than be a support. They always ask, what do I get from the community? But you're actually kind of saying, how would I actually be the person God wants me to be because I'm
right.
engaged in that community? Yeah.
Yeah, it sounded great at the time. And, but it has been good. I mean, it has been good for me.
Sure.
And You know, and particularly in making me realize how weak and selfish I am, and and at the same time too, I mean, it's been wonderful because they're great brothers.
Sure.
You know, people I've lived with. I have never lived in a community where I thought, oh, I'm glad I'm not with those guys anymore.
Mm.
Yeah, never.
Yeah.
And I've met wonderful, wonderful brothers, some of whom have gone to their reward.
Sure.
And, you know, who I trust are praying for me.
Sure.
Because they did when they were alive.
I mean, for me, I think of someone like Father Bede.
Who, yeah, exactly.
You're so close to it. And a father, yeah. Like for myself, like Father Vic, when I was in Benicia, we get to know some of the priest of, you know, kind of an earlier generation, and they can be inspired. I don't know. There's a kind of inspiration, like you were saying, you know, projecting, you know, when I'm older, do I want my legacy, or at least do what to make a difference in, you know, the magnetic fields of the earth, or, you know, the mineral, be a rock detective all of my life, or right. Something like that. Or do I want to, in a sense, have a different kind of, you know, make a difference in a different kind of way. And when you see Dominicans who have lived fully, passionately, faithfully, and they're coming towards the end of life, to be inspired by mm-hmm. that. And I just know you had that connection with Father Bede, and I'm sure that was a rich relationship for you,
yeah.
In the fraternity. Yeah.
Yeah. It was wonderful because he could yell at me, I could yell at him. And you know, Father Bede, you know, God bless him, had dementia towards the end of his life, but had been a brilliant preacher. Mm-hmm. And I had always heard stories about him, and just, you know, the wonderful generosity that he had, especially for the down and out, which I saw, even you know, in his, you know, old age and towards the end of his days, when I was in Tucson, living with him in Tucson, mm-hmm. you know, people would come in periodically from who knows where they were, but they were traveling, and you know, they would, one couple in particular asked me, you know, do you know who Father Bede Wilkes is?
Mm.
And I said, yes. And I said, well, you know, we were part of his community 25 years ago, and we just loved him. Do you know where he is now? And I had the delight of saying, well, he's here.
Nice.
I can take you to him. And I thought, you know, what an effect, you know, on someone's life, on this couple's life, that 25 years later, they'd still be thinking about him.
Yes.
By name. And, you know, wondering how he is. And, so
there's a real power there. Yeah, for us at St. Dominic's here, Father Felix, of course. is the parent. In fact, it was the other day I was up at the hospital, and someone said, "Oh, do you know Father Felix?" And they themselves haven't realized that he's passed away, so they obviously weren't in regular communication. Uh-huh. I said, "Oh, yes, I didn't." He's like, "Well, we're good friends." And now they say this not knowing he's passed away for several years, but in their mind,
sure.
Because of, and without, and I don't think they were, you know, exaggerating. They, no. when he was, when you were in his presence and you were really engaged in conversation or whatever, even the littlest interaction where you go around giving blessings, that sense of the warmth of friendship, that right. sense of love was there. So do you have any classic Father Bede story?
Yes.
Yes.
where to begin?
Oh, I was going to say, I'm putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, no, one that really made us realize that we needed to change course in how we were dealing with him is Father Bart Hutcherson was alone at the Newman Center, and I was working with the Catherine of Siena Institute, and so I was traveling all the time. So it was one of the times I was gone. I only heard about this when I got back. And all the other friars were gone, so it was just Father Bart and Father Bede. And Father Bede had dementia, and he was sundowning. Mm. And so Father Bart had the 5 o'clock Mass or whatever, and so he was at Mass, and Father Bede left and walked onto the campus at the University of Arizona, and found some people in a building, and said to them, I'm afraid of the man who gives me my pills.
Oh.
And so when Father Bart finished Mass, he walked out of the Newman Center Chapel and was met by Father Bede and two police officers.
Oh, my gosh.
Who were saying, are you the man who gives this man his pills?
Oh, no. And he was running a drug ring.
Right. So fortunately, things were straightened out. Okay. But that's when we realized, okay, that, you know, he had even forgotten Father Bart's name. And so you know, we, and you know, but it was, you know, seeing Father Bede, you know, as he declined, and yet seeing the brothers who would go and visit, and you know, the last one of the last visits, Father Barton had gone to see him, and at this point, Father Bede was, you know, non-communicative, and you know, even had a little helmet on because he would try to stand up, but it's unsteady and could fall and hurt his head. And but someone had come to play some music at this home where he was, not too far from the campus ministry. And Father Bart had happened to go and visit him and recorded it because the fellow was playing songs from the 30s and 40s, and which is Father Bede's era. And Father Bede had stood up and had started to dance.
Oh, wow.
With his big smile on his face.
Oh, neat.
And, you know, I mean, Father Bart was crying as he was videoing this. Sure. And, you know, when I saw the video, I had the same reaction.
Sure.
You know, just that sense. It brought him back to his childhood when he had to learn tap dance to strengthen his ankles because he had some foot problems when he was born. So... you know, just to see the solicitude with which the friars have for the elderly is really beautiful.
No, it really is that the fraternity, that almost it's a family, right?
Right.
And so even though there's not a sense of biological connection necessarily, that sense of having lived and ministered and at this point being there to care for those who are infirmed is such a it's a powerful witness and a privilege to be there. And
right.
Made me think of that when you were talking. We were talking about music. You have some musical ability yourself, do you not? I could say here's where I'm coming from. That sense of you certainly have the in terms of the academics, a very kind of the scientific side of yourself and the geology and all the rest. Right. But then also a very creative side to you in terms of music. I'm embarrassing you here.
So I studied piano starting when I was in second grade all through elementary and high school.
Yeah.
About in fifth grade, I began playing the soprano saxophone, my mom's instrument, which is now over 100 years old.
Yeah.
And then in high school, I picked up the bassoon.
Okay.
Because this, you know, the music we were playing, there's seldom music for soprano saxophone, and I got tired of playing cornet music or clarinet music, and there was a senior girl who was playing bassoon.
And
I could sit next to her.
There you go.
Of course, I was a freshman, which meant I didn't really exist.
Yeah.
So I stayed with the bassoon,
You lost the girl, but stayed with the instrument. Girl got away, but you got the bassoon.
Some consolation prize.
There you go.
Playing bassoon, it's like being the best opera singer in Tulsa.
Okay.
You know, that old saying.
Yeah.
Because not many people are playing bassoon.
Yeah.
And so...
only hot bands with bassoons in them.
Right. So, but I did, my band director when I was a junior had me audition for the McDonald's All-American Marching Band back when it existed. And, like 7-8 months later, I got a letter in the mail in the summertime, and you know, no one was home, and I just assumed I'd even forgotten that I had auditioned.
Oh, really? Okay.
And here's my rejection letter, and I opened it up, and it began, you know, congratulations, you have been selected.
Wow.
And you know, I did double take and
nice.
So I was in the McDonald's All American Marching Band.
Wow.
So came and marched in the Rose Parade in Los Angeles and in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and then they also gave concerts in Chicago.
Oh wow! So you toured with the
They would march in those two parades, but in L.A. and in New York and then in one other city, major city, they would give concerts. So I didn't march with the bassoon.
Yeah,
you know, I played saxophone in the parades, but in the concerts I played bassoon.
Nice.
And so that was a great experience, and I ended up studying music my first 2 years in college.
Okay.
I went to Illinois State University and was studying bassoon performance, and you know, my dad would always send me these, you know, starving artists.
Yeah.
he's an engineer, and you know, and so eventually I began thinking, you know, I'm good. I'm not ever going to be great, I don't think. And I want to be able to, you know, support a family and all this, and I also missed science. You know, I had, you know, studied math and science and loved it in high school, and I had a buddy from high school who was studying geophysics at University of Tulsa, and he would talk about what he was studying, and it really just sounded fascinating. So I took a geology course, and while I was taking music, I also taught I took a couple of calculus courses, and then I took a geology course just to see, you know, what this was like, and I really loved it. And so I ended up changing majors and changing universities.
Wow, so you had the two things. Do you see any, and I don't know if you've considered this, and maybe the answer is not really, but in terms of either the musical side or the science side, aspects of either those disciplines, either as directly or indirectly, that have served you well in terms of your own priesthood or Dominican life?
Yeah, I would say both have. You know, as I look back on my life and also in talking to folks who I had a sense knew that they were doing, you know, what God had created them to do.
Sure.
You know, when I was working with the Catholic Mission Institute, I began thinking about, you know, personal vocation and, you know, the call from God. And I would find people who, you know, I just had the sense, you know, they'd found their sweet spot. You know, they were doing, you know, they loved what they were doing, and they were passionate about it.
Yeah.
And so I'd ask them, and I heard the same thing over and over again, which also rang true with me, which was they'd say, everything now fits. Mm. Everything that I've done in the past, even things I thought were maybe a dead end, I see now how they fit.
Nice.
And I can say that with both music and geophysics. You know, music, you know.
Are there particular examples you're thinking of where, yeah?
Yeah, well, I was, you know, choir director in formation.
Yep. That tends to happen if you come into the if you come into the student tape with particular skills, you're going to put you to work.
So
you ran the choir here at St. Albert's
This is the pre-Cindy days when it's just a student brother who was given that responsibility.
I can only imagine
the enthusiasm.
Yes, that the other brothers must have had for your
completely underwhelming.
Yes.
Yeah, and somewhere along the line, when I was in like sixth or seventh grade, my sister started to show me how to play the organ at our local church. Mm. And it was only a couple of years later I realized she did that so she could stop doing, you know, playing the organ at Mass. And
she was forming her replacement.
Right. Yeah, she's 8 years older, so she was a little wiser than me.
Here, let me show you how to do this.
Right. And so, you know, throughout the years, I really enjoy singing now.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I mentioned, I'm you know, accompanying a Russian, 78-year-old Russian Jew who plays at two of our masses on Sunday and is a really, really accomplished flautist. And so we get together, and it's just fun for me. And it's he's delighted just to be able to. He spent decades just playing flute music without accompaniment, because he was, you know, a concert flautist in the Soviet Union.
Wow.
So it's just fun for me to see him, you know, have that pleasure of making music, and I just try to keep up. So, you know, singing the liturgy, and having an appreciation for music. But then also, you know, the Dominicans sent me back to finish my master's at Stanford when I was in formation. Mm-hmm. So after my second, my fourth semester of philosophy, I'd finished, I guess, my coursework, and they sent me to Stanford. My director took me back and got me a teaching assistantship, and so I took a couple classes and then finished my thesis. Did a little more research. I got some more samples myself, and just to have a larger sample size. So they did that. The Dominicans did that because they said, okay, Mike, you're interested in, you know, campus ministry.
Yeah.
Having a degree in geophysics, especially from Stanford, is going to raise questions. It's going to get people thinking about this. Even, you know, almost 30 years ago, even then there was still this sort of dichotomy between faith and science.
Yeah.
And certainly, working in campus ministry for 12 years, the first 12 years of my priesthood, it was a great conversation starter.
Nice.
And even right now, I'm reading a book by Stephen Barr, who's a professor of physics at the University of Delaware, called Modern Physics and Ancient Faith. So it's looking at design.
Yeah.
The questions of design in the universe, and it's fascinating.
Are there certain aspects of the field you studied or are familiar with that point to that kind of design? Because that's often a kind of principled approach to being able to say, hey, it's not faith on one hand and science on the other, but the two, obviously we believe that the source of faith is the source of creation and the laws of creation, you know, and so there's going to be interconnection, and we're going to be able to see, you know, signs and effects and remnants of the creator in the creation. Are there particular aspects that, without getting too much into the, I don't know if I know the undercurrents and the whatever you're talking about, of the mineral detective that you are, but are there general contours of design in that field that point to something beyond itself?
In a way, just the nature of creation, it's intelligible. It is organized.
Yeah.
And you know, our faith itself, Bishop Robert Barron is, you know, I think very good at you know, explaining this. You know, science arose in, you know, the Western Europe precisely because, you know, as Christians we did not worship nature. So you could study it.
Yeah.
It wasn't off limits, it wasn't something that was mysterious, not to be looked at too closely.
Yeah.
And you know, the idea that you know, there is a creator who for Christians is not beyond reason, is not like, you know, the God of Islam that is just absolute mystery and ineffable. You know, the God of Christianity reveals himself and speaks to us.
Yeah.
And does not act contrary to reason.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the idea that we can look at God's creation and then expect to find intelligibility, that study will be fruitful.
Nice.
And so certainly, I think in geophysics, in my, you know, particular field, it was interesting because even during my lifetime, there was a huge revolution in the way geologists looked at the Earth with the study of or the discovery of plate tectonics. And so I think, again, this idea that there is an intelligibility and we can learn more and revise, you know, our theories and our explanations for what is, you know, again, for me, it points to the idea that there's a real fruitfulness to the scientific study of the world.
Yeah, that's interesting because sometimes one of the overarching philosophical dictums of a creator and how science can't in principle contradict the faith is the question, why is there something rather than nothing, right? Science can't explain why there is. They could talk a lot about creation in there, but in the universe, but why is there a universe at all? What you're saying is if you will, adjacent to that, but a little bit different perspective. It's not why is there something rather than nothing, but why is the something that we encounter mean something? Why is it why is there a congruity between us as rational animals and the world we encounter around us that almost that implies a reason behind that reason. Mm-hmm. So that's it's not why is there something rather than nothing, but why does the something we encounter mean something? Why is there meaning at all?
Right.
It's a different aspect to launch into. Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, something, again, looking back, and I wasn't thinking of it, wasn't framing it in this perspective when I was thinking about, you know, what do I do with my life? But it really was a question of meaning.
Yeah.
You know, it would be one thing to study the magnetic field and try to understand, you know, plate tectonics and how it worked and how plates had moved in the past and all of this. But at the same time, there are, you know, people who are living on the streets.
Yeah.
And there's got to be something we can do with regard to that.
Sure.
And, you know, thinking about, you know, social work, you know, I was... At that point, I was thinking, you know, I need to do something directly. But when, at some point, when I began thinking about priesthood, I had this intuition that, you know, perhaps as a priest and preaching the gospel, I might be, in a sense, a catalyst. Mm. You know, God, or better, God working through me as a catalyst to touch the lives of other people, so that it you know, be a multiplication. Of effectiveness. And it's interesting because literally decades later, I you know, realized that this is an aspect of priesthood. It's the royal function, if you will, to help people discover their gifts and the call from God, and then to coordinate that. So really to act, in a sense, as a catalyst, you know, working with God, to help people understand their call, their purpose in life, and I remember finally making that connection and thinking, wow, this is something that God sort of planted in me, you know, decades before I knew anything about, you know, the triple munera, the priestly,
which is just which is what the triple munera,
the priestly, prophetic, and royal function. First of all the baptized, but then, you know, and in the baptized, it's directed towards the world, and for the priest, it's directed towards the baptized. You know, our priestly function is for the believers, and our prophetic function is directed, you know, primarily towards the faithful in preaching and teaching, and then, you know, the royal munera is precisely in coordinating the gifts and talents and skills of the laity for the good of the parish. And by that, I don't mean just the people in the St. Dominic's.
Yeah, the pews, yeah.
But in the territory, in the parish boundaries, all of the people, whether they're baptized or not.
I as you're talking, I'm reminded of that basic call that Christ gives the apostles, where he takes them, many of them famously fishermen, right? So they're working on the Galilean Sea, and he says, well, I'm calling you, and I'm going to make you a fisher of men. And so in your story, I almost hear echoes of that, and like, okay, you have this real, at least at that point, interest in learning magnetic fields and seeing how you've been kind of doing a discovery of how the world works and how this particular area, and seeing the occasion of poverty and wealth and meaning behind it gives you this kind of instinct to be catalytic in helping to kind of the significance of people's own sense of journey and call. Those kind of things are related. Just to kind of connect some of the ministries you've done, because you've hinted at some of those things, but you start off in campus ministry after ordination. So working, what was your experience working? And when I say campus ministry, just as Dominicans on a number of college campuses, you in fact mentioned Stanford, particularly where there are Dominicans. We have both the care for the salvation of the souls on that campus, but maybe describe a little bit about your experience in campus ministry as a priest.
Yeah, so I was at Arizona State University for 3 years, then University of Utah for 2 years, both as an associate, and then at University of Oregon as a director, and then at University of Arizona as a director for 1 year. So 6 years at Oregon, 1 year in Arizona. And very different campus ministries, some large, some small, you know, obviously being in Catholic in Utah is a kind of unique experience. And one of the things that you know, that I saw was that, you know, we were spending a lot of time and energy and resources on a fraction of the Catholic population at those universities. And, you know, the question always was, well, how do we, and yet, you know, keeping fairly busy.
Sure. It wasn't, you weren't sitting around.
Right. And because in all of those places, there were also, community, you know, there were communities of people who had gravitated to those campus ministries who were not associated with the university. And the campus ministry is not just for the students, it's also the faculty and staff, administration. But it was oftentimes very hard to get out of the Newman Center onto the campus and to interact. So that was a question. You know, how do we, you know, break out of this cycle? And sometimes, you know, at Utah, we started a ministry to the faculty, to the Catholic faculty.
Oh, nice.
At the university.
So not just the students, but right. anyone associated with the university.
Yeah. And going on campus and having, you know, like, I think, I can't remember if it was once a month or once a quarter, a meeting.
Just to be visible and present.
And, we'd have lunch with the Catholic faculty and then have some kind of a presentation and discussion.
Nice.
And a lot of times these were faculty who didn't know that, you know, these other faculty were Catholic.
Sure. That is great when you're in a non-Catholic setting and your presence connects other people who, oh, I didn't know you were Catholic.
Right.
It's an encouragement, just a visible presence. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I remember at the University of Oregon being invited to be part of a panel discussion for this, like there was the student, I think it was a class and they were learning media. They were learning. It was the students had kind of a, it was like a Geraldo Rivera style show.
Okay.
That they were, you know, they were producing and had a couple moderating, and this was going to be a show on pornography.
Mm.
And so the guests were a woman who ran a porn shop.
Okay.
A student who considered himself an aficionado of pornography.
Okay.
A woman who came, she worked with abused women, and me.
That sounds like the beginning of a joke.
Right.
Four people walk into into a studio.
And so, you know, I think what they were hoping for was a lot of yelling and screaming.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of fireworks and salacious,
you know,
things. And
a lot of, you know, condemnation for me.
Yeah.
And I remember praying before, you know, going on this thing and saying, you know, what, because I suspected this is what they were hoping for.
Sure.
So how do I approach this?
And so what you do.
what I ended up doing was, you know, just talking about the nature of human sexuality.
Mm.
You know, what is it about?
Yeah.
And at the first little break, one of the moderators, you know, came up to me and said, "You're going to be tougher than I thought." But at the end, the woman who ran the porn shop said, "Can I talk to you?"
Really?
And we talked for an hour afterwards.
Wow.
And, you know, she clearly was thinking, you know, about what she thinking about. You know, she had thought that, you know, her, what she said was, I'm just offering things to help people in their sex life.
Yeah.
You know, what could be wrong with that?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, how is that harmful? And, you know, I have no idea what I said. I mean, I don't remember anything about it. But
sure.
I remember that. I remember having that conversation
that
with
conversation.
Her and being deeply moved by it.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I mean, it was a graced moment. And God was at work in her life, certainly at that moment.
And I think one of, at least, I've never been on a campus ministry as my own directed ministry per se, but I feel like that might be a time in life when there's a fair bit of searching. I mean, not that people don't. I was reflecting the other day that we don't often change our minds, or at least we change our minds less than we think, right? And we think, oh, I'm open, I'm here. But, you know, when it comes to politics or faith, or even, we're just joking, in sports, you know, we've got our teams, we've got our things. And just to hear, to know when we are the instrument or part of a process where someone has a moment of inspiration or revelation to truly, I mean, this is what conversion is all about, right? To be part of that process. especially on a campus ministry, seems like there might be ample opportunity for that. Did you find that to be in terms of student life and people life? They're kind of searching for. They haven't hopefully made up their minds or feel like they're on totally on a team or an outlook on life. They're a little more formidable in terms of in both ways, right. In both senses of the word. But
yeah. On the one hand, students are often overwhelmed with schoolwork and their romantic lives and all this sort of thing, and thinking about what am I going to do with my life.
Sure,
but I think sometimes focusing on particular moments, because that's what I tend to remember. I was at Oregon and we had a alternative spring break. We would go down to Mexico and. Work in the parish, provide a Bible study for the kids. This particular parish was trying to build a dispensary, for food and medical supplies. And so we were, I've still got scars on my forearms from concrete, that was stuck in my skin and, end up burning it. But
wounds of love.
Yeah.
Labor of love.
I remember one year this young man who was, he was in a fraternity and he was coming to confession very regularly and needed to.
Sure.
And he came one day and said, I want to go on this, spring break trip. And I thought, I was surprised, but, certainly welcomed him. And all during, on the spring break, we would do work during the day, but we'd have prayer in the morning, we'd have mass in the evening, and then after dinner we'd have reflection. What are you experiencing? What's God bubbling up, in your life? And every night he's, wow, this is incredible. I can't believe what's going on. And I was skeptical.
Yeah.
And thinking, okay, you're saying that now, but we'll go back to Eugene and there'll be the life as usual.
Kind of a prisoner of the moment, over emotional.
And lo and behold, God was really working very, very powerfully in his life. And I remember, his goal had been to make $1 million before he was 30. And of course, this is, good 20 plus years ago. So $1 million went a little further.
Yes. So $10 million by today's standards.
But when he graduated with a business degree, he joined the Jesuit Volunteer Corps.
Oh, wow.
And did that for a year or two. And then he became a recruiter for the JVCs. And then he started working, eventually went to work for I think the March of Dimes. And now he works in the Archdiocese of Denver in development.
Really? Wow.
And, I had the great joy of witnessing his marriage.
Oh, my goodness.
The woman he married, the first date, he asked her if she was Catholic.
Oh, wow, okay.
So if you told me that this would be,
his trajectory.
Justin's trajectory, I was like, no way. But, again, it wasn't me.
Yeah.
God was at work. And I didn't believe it.
Mm.
This has happened to me several times, I hope the Lord has convinced me now, but he really can turn someone's life around.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of what drives me now.
Yeah.
So I did campus ministry for 12 years. I then worked with the Catherine Siena Institute for 7 years with Sherry Waddell.
Yeah, which would just to say here at St. Dominic's, at least once a year, usually in the spring during the days after Easter and Pentecost, we have one of their cornerstone projects or evaluations they call them gifted works, the workshop that's come out of there. But how was that? How was that? Because that was several years you were the director.
7 years.
Yeah, seven
I
years.
Worked with Sherry.
Well, you were was that Jacob in the working with Laban 7 years.
Right, right. and it was an amazing experience. Certainly itinerant.
You were on the road a lot.
I was on 250 days a year probably.
Wow.
Because we were getting quite busy.
Wow.
And it was a fantastic ministry. Yeah. I learned so much. You know, Sherry is wonderful and brilliant, and it was great working with her. Yeah. You know, we did a lot of collaboration.
Yeah.
And it wasn't all just, you know, giving, calling it workshops.
Sure.
Because probably maybe in the second year, I think, I remember Sherry had an experience that really changed the direction of the Institute. Mm. After a calling after workshop, ideally there's a one-on-one interview with someone who's been trained mm-hmm. to listen to someone's stories, someone's
yes.
experiences, and help them do some further discernment on possible charisms they may have. And Sherry was interviewing a woman who was very active in her parish. I think she's on the parish council. She was active in the archdiocese that she lived in. And yet her scores had been pretty low on the inventory. Mm. And as she spoke, Sherry wasn't really hearing any great evidence of charisms being manifested. And so she asked the woman, you know, tell me about your lived relationship with God to this point in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking that she would hear, well, when I was, you know, 30, I had a spiritual awakening of some kind. And,
sure.
And so then she would focus on that moment, you know, in, you know, to the present.
Yeah.
And the woman thought for a moment and said, I don't have a relationship with God. And Sherry thought, well, you know, to herself, that can't be.
Yeah.
Why would you be so active in your parish and in the archdiocese if you didn't have a relationship with God? So yeah. I must have asked the question the wrong way.
So, yeah.
So she tried probing and asking in different ways and finally came to the realization the woman was telling the truth.
Hmm.
You know, obviously God had a relationship with her.
Sure.
But you know, she was acting as though the church was like the Lions Club or, you know, Kiwanis. You know,
yeah. not
good people. They yeah. did nice things for other folks and were helpful. And
like a social club of some
yeah,
sort.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And
the Rotary or something.
So this, you know, we realized that maybe this isn't just this unique situation. Maybe this happens more than we realize, that there are people who are, you know, involved in church, you know, because they're good people and they like to help others. But maybe God isn't like the motivating factor. And you know, maybe we were assuming too much sometimes. And so that really got us thinking about evangelization.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sherry is a great researcher. And it was, you know, from this question, how do we help people have, you know, what Pope Benedict called this encounter.
Yeah.
This encounter that gives life new meaning and new direction.
Yeah.
You know, so that, you know, was the beginning of looking at, you know, what ended up becoming, you know, the whole Making Disciples.
Michael's Disciples and Forming Disciples.
Forming Intentional Disciples book. And now the next step is, you know, Ananias training. So, you know, Forming Intentional Disciples is about helping people through, you know, thresholds of conversion from I don't believe in God to, you know, I'm following Jesus. He is my Lord, and my goal is to do His will in my life.
And there's a whole set of stages there. That everything from you know, curiosity to
initial trust, curiosity, openness to spiritual change, seeking the relationship, and then discipleship, which is sort of like marriage. You know, I mean, this really is describing a growth in a relationship.
Yeah,
and so. You know, I think any couple who is married can think about, you know, their own relationship and the growth of the relationship. You know, I began to, you know, see this young woman and I, you know, we talked and I became interested in her, curious, you know, and as we talked, you know, the trust deepened and, you know, eventually, you know, I became open to doing something different that I would never do. You know, I'm going to go watch, you know, When Harry Met Sally.
Yes. You know. You're watching rom-coms.
Right.
And, the things you do for love.
Yes, exactly. And you know, then you start thinking, well, is she the one? Could I you know, spend my life with her? And so this is sort of the equivalent to the spiritual threshold of seeking.
Yeah.
You know, can I make a commitment to following Jesus or not? And then, you know, marriage... Yeah, you're making this commitment, but you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You don't know what the future holds. It's just when we made solemn vows.
Yeah.
We had no idea what
until
was going to
happen. Exactly.
Yeah, it's a radical act of generosity.
That's
you know,
right.
You're given the whole of your life, but you don't know what that entails. And so, you know, this whole look at evangelization and asking, you know, how do we help form people to be evangelizers in the context of relationships that they already have, where there's already initial trust. You know, so I'll give you an example from my own life. You know, there were, when I was working with the Institute, I was, when I was in Colorado Springs, because that was the base of the,
it still remains the base, that has, is the hub of
the Catherine Stanton Institute.
Operational organization,
So I would be going back there to meet with Sherry and to work on things. And I'd go to the gym. I had a membership at a local gym. And, you know, I met some older guys there, a couple of older guys were there every day, every day. And
workout warriors.
Yeah. And they were like in their 60s and early 70s. Okay. And neither of them were churched or anything like that. And they knew another fellow that I was working out with, another fellow who had had a really powerful conversion that I ran across when I was saying daily mass, you know. And who's, you know, still a dear friend. And so these guys knew I was a priest, and, you know, they would come and talk to me. And it got to the point where, you know, they asked me to bless their motorcycles, you know. Okay. And then, you know, one guy invited me to his home to have dinner with him and his wife. And, you know, so I could see, you know, this trust building, and then curiosity, because one day we'd played racquetball, and, you know, we sat down afterwards and had a beer, and you know, one of them looked at me and said, "Why did you become a priest?" You know, so I to see these thresholds, and so I was thinking, oh, okay, what can I do? He's spiritually curious about me.
Yeah.
But how do I turn this now to be curious about Jesus?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the whole notion of these thresholds is that, you know, if you're aware of what they are and where someone may be at a particular point, then you can think, okay, what can I do to help encourage them to cross this next threshold?
Yeah.
And again, it's all a work of grace, and so God is the one who helps them. But again, he uses us.
Yeah.
So... you know, now the Catherine Stanton Institute is also working on what they call the Ananias Project, which is training people to accompany folks who are on these journeys or who have made the journey and who are now sort of baby disciples, but need help with kind of, you know, integrating faith into their everyday life.
And
just like St. Paul.
I was going to say, that's the story that St. Paul, when he's struck blind on the road to Damascus, it goes in and is, well, Ananias himself has a moment of of fear when God tells him to shepherd Paul, or Saul at that point, into the church. And he's like, "Lord, do you know who this is?" He's like, "Yeah, I know who he is." Paraphrasing here. He's like, "You know who this guy is?" He's like, "Yeah." So that role of Ananias, no Ananias, there's no St. Paul, right?
Right.
I mean, Paul needed that sense of accompanying, of welcome at the very beginning when he was literally still in his blindness, to be welcomed and connected to the church. And I just to step back, you're talking about evangelization and being an evangelist. Those aren't, I don't say this in the right way, those aren't either familiar or maybe even comfortable Catholic words or language. Right. I know myself going to an evangelical high school myself, there wasn't, for my little Catholic, that language, you know, it's not as if it's antithetical to the faith. It's not just as Catholics, we don't usually use that terminology. If someone were to ask you, what does it mean to be an evangelist just in a Catholic kind of, from the Catholic tradition, how would you describe it or define being an evangelist and how we're all called to be that way?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's a great question. And I think fundamentally and ideally, it's to be able to connect, the story of Jesus and my own story. So that it's not simply, you know, this abstract idea, but to be able to say, you know, Jesus came to save us, and, you know, the cross is a part of that. But I've also experienced redemption myself. I've experienced healing because of my encounter with Jesus. And so I can tell you about that. Right. And it can even get to the point where, again, if I'm, say, I'm trying to help you, you know, have this encounter, a similar encounter with Jesus.
Sure.
And I know what threshold you're at.
Yeah. So say I'm curious or
yeah,
something.
So you're curious. Yeah. I can look back perhaps in my own life, in my own journey of faith. Okay, where, what was it like when I was curious, when I was at that same threshold? Mm. And how did Jesus help me cross that? Mm. You know, what happened that I went from simply being, you know, curious to actually being open to change?
Mm.
And, you know, so it's connecting. So I think for me, you know, evangelization is being able to connect the great story of Jesus.
And salvation,
And salvation with my story.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in training people to be evangelists, that means that we have to be able to tell the story of Jesus and actually tell the story of salvation.
Yeah.
You know, there are sort of like 9 different acts we can look at, you know, from the beginning. You know, God loves us and created the world.
Yeah, so Genesis, yeah.
Right. You know, to be able to talk about the fall, but actually that shows up later, even though that's the next thing in the story of salvation. Postmoderns aren't ready to hear about sin and, you know, the fall until, you know, later. Yeah. But, you know, to talk about, you know, God loves us and sent someone to reveal that love in a very potent way.
Yeah.
And so to be able to talk about, you know, Jesus, his teaching, even the miracles of Jesus. And so, be able to lay out the story, but oftentimes people aren't, you know, ready to hear it all in one shot.
Yeah.
You know? It's what are they curious about?
Yeah. Or they assume things and they're quite, you know, pop culture has a way of framing that story, which is not always either generous or truly informed on different parts. When you know, people will say, oh, I had this other day, you know, because I was doing RCIA in Genesis, and they said, well, you Christians, you believe in talking snakes, so that's all that myth kind of thing. And I thought, yes, there is the account in Genesis of the serpent speaking, but you're kind of missing the point if you think that's like a zoological reference. Like if you think our faith is based on you know, kind of talking snakes as a kind of literal kind of thing in the way that modernity would frame a story, you've kind of missed the ancient Near Eastern way of what revelation, this insight of God, is giving to that. So even clearing things like that up, you know,
exactly.
Even just communicating the story authentically, or at least talking about what was the behind the story, if you will.
Yeah, and you know, we're not biblical fundamentalists.
Yeah, exactly.
We recognize the different types of literature in the scriptures.
Yep.
And, you know, but you're right.
Yeah.
You know, what's presented, and I think part of this is because of the influence of, you know, Christian fundamentalism in this country. That's the story, or that's the way of interpreting scripture that is in the popular mindset.
Yeah,
because that's what people see and hear oftentimes.
And what occurs to me that is, in order to be an evangelist and in a sense be able to tell the story of salvation and to be able to relate that to others and try to connect their own story or meet them, it implies that we ourselves have made a connection with our story of salvation, and the very act of helping and accompanying others helps us to both understand our own story in a way that we wouldn't have. Like, you know, I'm sure you've had the experience of and people talk about how, you know, they came to a deeper appreciation of the faith when they had to share their faith, right? Because suddenly they had to make connections, or they were given the opportunity to make connections that they wouldn't have if the opportunity to share that with others hadn't come up. And so the first person, like, there's so many moments when you know, you're talking about God calling us to be an evangelist, and it's not, I mean, God can work his blessing, you know, in so many hypothetical ways. He can just directly inspire everyone, but making us part of the process isn't just for the quote unquote other person. The first person that's converted when we attempt to share that story and be an evangelist is ourselves.
Right.
Right. And so that's the great, both, if you will, the spiritual physics that, that's set up in the system, if you will, of the work of evangelization. The first one evangelizes is the evangelizer.
Right.
But, that sense then of that personal connection of sharing story is basically what Christ is, imitation of Christ in that way.
And I think St. Paul is a great example of this in his preaching.
Yeah.
You know, several times he talks about his former life.
Yes.
You know, both as, you know, a very devout Jew and as well as someone who persecuted the early church.
Yeah.
But also talks about his conversion and, and his relationship. You know, I live no longer I, but Christ is living in me.
Yeah.
You know, that sense of intimacy and that I am changed.
Mm-hmm.
But not I'm changed into something completely different.
Yeah.
More of I am now who I always was meant to be.
Yes.
You know, this is the authentic me.
Yeah, the best version of the self kind of thing in a graced way, not in a kind of a self-help way, but in a way that God has created me to be.
Right. Yeah. And so I think one of the challenges for me as a preacher, and I'm just kind of realizing this even as we speak, I have to be able to help people connect. First of all, to see the great story as it's, you know, laid out, because in the you know, liturgical preaching, we're given just, you know, short little stories and segments of the great story. But to be able to help, first of all, make the connection with my own life.
Yeah.
You know, how has this story, or how has the principle behind the story, what is Jesus doing? How has he done that for me?
Yeah.
And then to invite people to reflect on, well, has he done this for you?
Yeah.
And can you make the connection here with what's gone on in your own life or what's happening even right now?
Yeah.
You know, how does the story give you hope at this moment or challenge you?
Yeah.
But that's I think part and parcel of evangelization.
Yeah, and it just gets me fired up to preach. Like two preachers talking about evangelism. You're like, yeah, let's go do this.
Right.
And has there been maybe to transition to maybe a final point? Now, as pastor, you have certainly the responsibility of bringing this, at least, and I know how passionate you are about the kind of project of a parish, not in terms of so-called like maintenance of just kind of, okay, a parish is just there for the sacramental life, which is wonderful and beautiful, but as Dominicans, we're called to truly have a mission to form and make disciples, to be evangelists. Would that everyone who is connected to the parish wasn't just had a spiritual care in the terms of sacramental life, but was empowered to be an evangelist. From your work in kind of Called and Gifted in the Catherine of Siena Institute and traveling, you went to a lot of parishes, so there was certainly, I'm sure, joys and challenges of being a lot of, but now you're at one parish and trying to, you know, implement or trying to kind of see how you can kind of build that fire, be catalytic. What have you discovered perhaps in the realities and the joys of putting that into practice, or at least trying to enflesh that in a particular place?
Yeah, theory is wonderful.
It always looks so neat on paper.
Right, right.
Even for the physicist, right?
Yes, exactly.
And you get exploring the ocean and things are not exactly what they look like on the computer.
And so St. Dominic's in Los Angeles is a wonderful place. And I remember the first weekend I was there giving out communion, I was crying.
Mm.
Because, you know, for one thing, the music was beautiful, mm-hmm. just very, very well done. And the church is beautiful. And the church is full.
Mm.
You know, St. Dominic's in L.A. is probably about 80-85% Filipino, I would say.
Okay.
And, many of them are first generation, so they've emigrated.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Certainly among the older folks, they are all immigrants. And even among the people my age and in younger, in their 40s maybe, a lot of them were born at least in the Philippines. They may have been brought here by their parents when they were young, but you know, there's lots of strong, strong connections still to the Philippines. And I think part of the challenge is, and I'd say maybe for the first year or so, I was just amazed because we can have 300 people at Wednesday morning mass, because afterwards we have a novena to Our Lady Perpetual Help, which is very popular in the Philippines.
Yeah.
And, but even other days, you know, between the two masses we have each day, there's probably 200 people coming to mass, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
As I've been there longer, I've, you know, first of all, I'm challenged by the different culture.
Sure.
I mean, I'm not Filipino. I've never been around Filipinos.
This is where a podcast doesn't have to communicate.
Right. Fortunately, you know, we have Filipino brothers.
Yes.
And
who's with you, Brother Josh?
Brother Josh. Yeah. You know, has come to preach the Rosary Sunday a couple of times, but he's here at St. Albert's given me some resources. You know, some things on Filipino spirituality, folk spirituality.
Yeah.
Which I'm going to be reading and sharing with the brothers.
Sure.
Maybe at a lectors meeting.
There you go.
because, you know, what does discipleship look like in this different culture?
Yeah.
And maybe it doesn't look exactly like what I'm expecting it to.
Yeah.
And so, again, I don't want to miss it. But part of it, I think part of the challenge is, you know, the Philippines is a Catholic culture.
Sure.
And in some ways, the culture there has been formed, you know, by Spanish colonialism and, you know, the piety that the Spaniards, you know, introduced. And now, you know, these folks are in the American secular culture, which is very powerful, very attractive in many ways, and you know, promises a lot. Promises things that drew some of these immigrants in the first place. They're not fleeing persecution. They're not fleeing religious persecution.
It's kind of like the American dream of prosperity.
Exactly.
How does the prosperity gospel perhaps get in the way of the gospel of both persecution, but of ultimately salvation?
Right.
Yeah.
And the embrace, you know, of suffering even, you know, take up your cross daily. You know, Jesus does not, he says, if they persecuted me, they'll persecute you.
Yeah.
And so, this is not something that's a popular, you know, message, and certainly we don't seek persecution or suffering.
Yeah.
But there is a whole spirituality around it when it does surface, as it inevitably does in our life.
Sure.
But for me, I think the question is, for people who are coming to Mass faithfully, even daily, who are going to confession regularly, how do we help communicate that maybe there's something more? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there's an even deeper relationship that Jesus wants with you that you haven't recognized. Or, it's also possible, maybe because I haven't had enough conversations with folks, maybe there's a very profound relationship there that I've not recognized and I need to discover. And this is, I think, part of the challenge of being in a very busy, active parish
ministry.
Having those conversations, you know, they don't just happen.
No.
I really have to pursue them.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of as I'm talking, this is, I'm kind of excited about going back to have some of these conversations.
Because
I've had some. I've had some with a few people.
Yeah.
But I want to have more. And Brother Josh was giving me some cues, some things to ask, some questions to ask that he says are going to be really helpful. So, you know, I think, you know, your question again, just so I'm trying to address it.
No, no, yeah, just at this point, I think we're this has been delightful. It's been over an hour.
There's
no particular question, but no, I think it goes back to what I'm reminded of when you're talking about the idea of putting into place, or at least in fleshing in a particular parish, kind of the themes of called and gifted and the evangelist and making that work. It's every place is going to be a little bit different based on cultural realities. Even San Francisco, you know, it's there's a melting pot of folks, but there's a there's a Catholic culture that's also deeply embedded. But what you're making me think of is when you kind of joked, I know, half seriously, for your own vocation, you didn't get a calling, you got a question, and that question kind of stayed with you, and maybe what it means to be someone who's catalytic towards that is to simply ask the questions.
Right.
This isn't the plant the seeds of the interrogative, of the question, right, in people's minds and hearts.
Which is what Jesus said.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he asked lots of questions. Yeah. You know, people would ask him questions. Yeah. He'd most often respond with a question.
Yeah, how infuriating was that? You're like, I want the answer, Lord. Give it to me. Just like, I just want a prepackaged. Tell me what to do. Right. And instead, what does he do? Open-ended question that makes you be part of the journey. takes ownership.
Yeah. And reflect.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, so, you know, when, and again, in our culture, which is so busy and hectic, you know, we don't have time.
Yeah.
We don't take time to stop and reflect and ask about the meaning of events.
Yeah.
You know, where might God be in this event? And what might God be asking of me? You know, what does it mean to be authentically human in this moment? What does it mean to be authentically present to you as we have this conversation? How do I really listen and not try to anticipate what you're going to ask and formulate a response before I've actually heard? In ministry and in a busy parish, I think part of it is giving people a vision that there is something else to Christianity that maybe they haven't thought about or haven't even experienced yet. And to be able to witness to that, Sherry Waddell made a comment some years ago when I was working with her. I can't remember even how exactly it came up, but we were talking about living as a Christian, and basically, and she pointed out. She said, "You know, Father Mike, you seem to have a category in your head for saints,
yeah,
and you have a category for kind of." You know, what you think of as everybody else who are basically kind of muddling along and maybe not even thinking too much about God or about church or anything like that.
Yeah.
You don't seem to have a category for the disciple, for the person who has had an encounter with Christ, has had a change in their life, but is still muddling along.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing their best to follow Christ.
Yeah.
They know they're supposed to follow Christ, but they aren't perfect.
Hmm. Well, that's your next book, The Muddling Saint. That's what I'm calling right now. Yeah.
And, you know, but that's, you know, if I didn't have that category after having been a priest for, you know, 15 years, you know, maybe there are other people who don't have that category too.
Yeah.
And so how to describe that and how to give examples of it. You know, I think a lot of Catholics in a way are kind of afraid of sanctity.
Yeah.
Or even to talk about striving for it,
yeah.
Because what's the response so often? It's like, well, who do you think you are?
Exactly. Or everyone's human by meaning we're less than that.
Right.
But there's that yearning there, right?
Yeah.
We don't often talk about it. It seems too lofty, but when we got it, we that's what we desire. We desire it all. We desire that love. Yeah.
And we're afraid of being called a hypocrite.
Yeah.
You know, which oftentimes I think is nothing more than, I mean, certainly hypocrisy exists. But I think a lot of times when people want to slap that label on us, it's simply because we aren't perfect.
Yeah.
And the fact that I'm trying to follow Jesus and trying to discern his will for my life, and at the same time I get upset with you and, you know, I yell and, you know, I'm not what people think a saint looks like.
Sure.
You know, doesn't mean I'm a hypocrite.
Yeah,
it just means I'm a disciple.
That's right. Christian way was it. Catholics aren't perfect. We just believe in the power of forgiveness. Right?
Exactly.
We're just, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, you know what? I've got like 6 different more questions, but I think I promised, full disclosure, I promised a 20-minute podcast. So I think we're 4 times over. It's been delightful to talk to you. Huge fun. So it just means we've got to have you back sometime.
Thank you very much, Michael. You know, people like to talk about ourselves.
And not only that, just about the preaching and the ministry. So welcome. Well, if you perdure toward the end of this epic Father Michael's podcast. May the Lord bless you in all you do. And so whether you're on the go or you're simply taking it slow, many, many blessings as you have enjoyed today's show. And may everything you do truly radiate the joy of the gospel here in the heart of the city. Amen.
Amen.